Well, thank you very much for that introduction. As you said, I have just flown in from Berlin, where it is 28 degrees and sunny. I have to say, I'd rather be here because it's been such a warm and lovely event. So thank you to CAB for inviting me. And I also like a big round of applause for my lovely assistant, Bridget. I've dragged up here because of her wonderful sign, Recycle Menwith. And the reason I wanted to point this out is because in Berlin, there are some historic sites from the Cold War. And I've recently visited the Stasi HQ. The Stasi was the East German secret police. Had a death grip on the freedoms of its people. It had about 10% of the population spying for it, and it seemed immutable. And yet now it is merely a museum. Its power has been destroyed. And also just outside Berlin, there's something called the Teufelberg, which is a lot like Menwith Hill. Golf balls on the top, where the Allies used to spy on their Soviet adversaries. This too has gone. This too is crumbling. And if you go up there now, it is a place where peace activists gather, and there are rainbow flags and artworks all over this former spying installation. So I just want to say this to give you hope. This place is not immutable. This place will not be here forever, and we will have peace at some point in our time. So thank you very much to Bridget for that. Okay, I've got about 30 minutes to talk about all things spies, whistleblowing, and privacy, and Snowden. And he, in my view, is a hero. If we have any of our little friends from the police who are listening into this, I just want to reassure them I will not be breaking any laws. I will not be breaking the Official Secrets Act. Everything I'll be talking about is already in the public domain, has been cleared for my book. So that's just a helpful reminder, I hope. So my background is as a British intelligence officer working for MI5, and I was recruited in 1990 and worked there until late 1996. Some of you may remember a whistleblowing case involving a man called David Shaler, who exposed a whole range of wrongdoings and crimes by the spy agencies in the late 1990s. He was my ex-partner. He is my ex-partner. He was my ex-colleague. And we decided to resign in disgust at what we saw and to blow the whistle on the crimes of the spies. And in fact, facing arrest and prosecution and separation, we decided to preemptively go on the run before the story broke. So we did a sort of Edward Snowden, but 15 years earlier. The whole range of things we saw going wrong, it just went on for 6 years. And every time we moved section, we thought things would be better. And every time we were reposted to a new era of investigation, things got worse. And this was in the 1990s, the only marginally golden ethical era of MI5's 100-year existence, because they hadn't officially existed until 1989 when they were put on a legal footing for the first time. They could and did whatever they wanted and got away with it. As a 1980s whistleblower, Peter Wright, who wrote Spycatcher, said, they could bug and burgle their way around London with impunity, and they did. So in 1989, they went on official footing. And then, of course, since 9/11, the intelligence gloves famously came off. So the 1990s were better. But despite that, we saw so many things going wrong that we felt compelled to resign and go public. So what do we see? First of all, working in the counter-subversion section, which sounds terribly grand, but was actually counter-activism section. This is where they spied on an industrial scale on people like us, for our political activities and our legitimate democratic activities. And they had hundreds of thousands of files on UK citizens for their involvement in campaigns. They also had files on a range of politicians. I do like shit stirring, but that's a bit big for me. We also saw, because we had a very historic perspective of what they had been doing through the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, not only the sheer scale of their investigations into UK citizens, but also the range of files they held on up-and-coming Labour MPs. Now, in 1992, when there was a general election and they all had their files, their names vetted against the registry, and anyone with a file had it pulled out of registry and assessed by us, most of these people were not that well known. Come 1997, however, it all changed. Suddenly we saw that Tony Blair and David Blunkett and Jack Straw and the late Robin Cook and Patricia Hewitt and Harriet Harman and Peter Mandelson, anyone who's anyone in the Labour administration, had a file held on them historically by MI5. And I think this is a real problem for a democracy, where these people were supposed to be their political masters, And yet the spies held secret information on them. They weren't allowed to know what it was. So I think it was a situation very much democratically of the tail wagging the dog. And I think this goes some way to explaining why a so-called Labour government was so willing to give so many more powers, so much more money, so many more staff to our spy agencies. We then worked in the Irish section, and again we saw things going wrong, where bombs could and should have been prevented by MI5, and yet they were allowed to go off, or they happened to go off. Mistakes were made. And then crucially, MI5 did not report their mistakes to government. They lied to government and covered these things up and did not learn from the mistakes to improve the way they worked. And finally, we worked in international terrorism, something called G-Branch. And here we saw the cases that made us quit, and here we saw the cases that made us decide to go public. This included an illegal phone tap on a very prominent Guardian journalist called Victoria Britton, which invaded her privacy grossly for a half a year and cost the taxpayer £750,000. We also saw two innocent Palestinian students wrongfully convicted of the bombing of the Israeli embassy in London in the summer of 1994. MI5 knew they were innocent, and they withheld the evidence from the trial. So these two young students, Sama Alami and Jawed Botmi, were convicted of conspiracy to cause this attack, and they both received sentences of 20 years, most of which they served. And finally, the worst case, in our view, the straw that broke the camel's back, was in 1996 when MI6, our James Bond wannabes, ended up getting involved in a conspiracy to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. Now, in this case, they funded a ragtag group of Islamic extremists headed up by a Libyan military intelligence officer in an attempt to kill Gaddafi. Now, this was illegal under UK law because they did not get the prior written permission of the Foreign Secretary, notionally their political master, a man, by the way, who in that day was Sir Malcolm Rifkind, who is now in charge of the Intelligence and Security Committee, precisely to oversee the work of the spies. He claimed he never signed permission. So this operation was, of course, illegal under UK law. It was funding our known terrorist enemies at the time, and it went wrong because Gaddafi, of course, survived to be assassinated 3 years ago by the very same groups. It killed innocent people, though. In the explosion itself and the ensuing security shootout, innocent people standing on the street were shot and killed. So this was the case where we just thought we can't carry on working for an intelligence community in the UK, which was actually effectively making the UK a state sponsor of terrorism. So this is why we resigned and we went to the newspapers. We knew what we were risking. Automatically, if you speak to anyone outside the agencies for which you work, you face 2 years in prison. There is a clear, bright line against disclosure put in place after the whistleblowing scandals of the 1980s, Clive Ponting, Kathy Massiter, Peter Wright. So the 1989 Official Secrets Act is there specifically to stop whistleblowers. So this is why we decided to go to the newspapers and preemptively go on the run. Now, this was a lot easier in those days. There wasn't endemic CCTV around. We knew their capabilities of what they could pick up electronically, but it was still damn frightening. We had a month literally on the run around Europe. I then went back and knew that I was going to be arrested, purely for being David Chalmers' girlfriend at that point, by the way. And then we had 10 months hiding in a very remote French farmhouse while we tried to get the most serious allegations investigated by the government. They always refused. And to this day, they continue to refuse. David was then arrested in Paris in the summer of 1998 because the British tried to extradite him. And he went to prison for up to 4 months, just waiting for the case to be heard. Now, we'd fled to France because we knew that they protected whistleblowers. And thank God for that, because that advice had been right. After 4 months in prison, half of it in solitary confinement, the French released him. So I have to say, if anyone ever has to go on the run, please go to Paris. I wish Snowden had looked into this. We then had another 2 years in Paris, working on the stories, getting more information out, and took it as far as we could. And in 2000, David returned to the UK voluntarily, knowing that he would be arrested, knowing that he would be put on trial under the Official Secrets Act, and knowing that he would be found guilty and go to prison. And he handed himself in. He did what the Americans say Snowden should do, which is man up, face the music. Well, Shayla was facing 6 years, and that was difficult enough, but he felt it was the right thing to do, to force an inquiry into these very serious allegations. But if I was Snowden facing 35 years, if not life in prison, I don't think I would want to self-immolate like that. Anyway, of course, he was found guilty. He went back to prison, thankfully only got a six-month sentence, and was released after a third of that. But the price that you pay as a whistleblower is intensely high. The years of the stress, the fact that you are demonised on the one hand by as a traitor, and then hero-worshipped on the other as a hero. And it's very stressful on the psyche. And, of course, you become unemployable. Nobody else will give you a job. So you end up broke. You give up your entire career. And, of course, in the case of intelligence whistleblowers, you give up your freedom too. So it's a very high price to pay. And I salute the whistleblowers who've come out over the last decade because they are facing higher and higher prices, particularly in America. One of the key lessons I learned from those years, though, was what it was like to live without the sense of privacy at all. So we knew that our telephones were bugged. We knew our emails were intercepted. We knew that our home was bugged, including probably our bedroom. And we also found out afterwards that some of our friends had been co-opted. They'd been forced to report back on us to the police. And this is very corrosive because you begin to self-censor. You can't talk freely on the phone, even to your family. You can't just relax at home. And this self-censorship is very corrosive to the sense of being a private individual and a private citizen. Now, of course, we know that we all live like this. We all live like this under the jackboot of the NSA and its partner, its willing partner, GCHQ. As I said at the beginning, what we're looking at is the halcyon years of MI5, the 1990s, when they were slightly more ethical, when they did think about obeying the law. Since then, of course, since 9/11, we've seen a slide down a very dangerous path where they have been involved in torture and they've been sued for it and have had to pay for it. And because of that, they now insist on having these hearings in secret courts in the UK, where they've been implicated in extraordinary rendition cases of terrorist suspects, i.e. kidnapping, where they have allowed their intelligence to be politicised and they've made up fake intelligence to take this country into illegal wars across the Middle East. And many of us protested against the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and it did nothing. And that was so demoralising for the peace movement. But I think there has been a shift. There was an outcry against our intervention in Libya. And, of course, there was an even stronger outcry, because we all see through this sham pretense of the war on terror now. There is an even stronger outcry in the attempt to try and invade Syria. And thank God we did that. And there was not a vote to take this country into another murderous war. So things do shift. However, the spies still seem to get away with it time and time and time again. They seem inviolable. They never seem to be held to account by their political masters. How can we hold these people to account? What are the mechanisms that we can demand they obey the law? Well, first of all, one form of accountability would, of course, be the media if they did their bloody jobs. But they never do. The mainstream media are part of the problem. They are complicit. They are not speaking truth to power. They are not holding these people to account. And they are not telling us the full truth. And in the past, when I used to do talks about this, people would say, oh, no, you're a conspiracy theorist. Of course we have a free media. It's Britain. Well, we know now from the phone hacking scandal the collusion that goes on at the very highest levels between Dave Lots of Love Cameron and people like Rebecca Brooks. The media has been merged and put into corporatist hands gradually over the last few decades. It's now estimated that virtually all of the Western media is controlled pretty much by about five major companies, if you follow the money. This is not a free media. This is a media where the owners tell the editors what stories they're going to cover. And if the editors do stand up and do follow proper stories and tell hard news, those stories will be spiked. They will be threatened with prosecution under the Terrorism Act. They will be threatened with injunctions, with government injunctions, with libel suits, and, of course, with the Official Secrets Act. The UK is unique in the West because not only are whistleblowers criminalised by exposing wrongdoing, but the journalists who break those stories can be criminalised too and face 2 years in prison under Section 5 of the Official Secrets Act. And, in fact, I heard recently at a conference, even in Russia, if there's a whistleblowing case The whistleblower goes to prison, sure, not a nice prison. But the journalists are specifically protected by the Constitution of Russia. So we are worse than Russia, democratically. That's how bad, that's how far we've slid over the last 10 years. And it's interesting, I think, looking at the coverage of the Snowden files. You know, Snowden, a brave young man, someone who knew what he was facing by going public, 35 years in prison, at least. Someone who knew when he went public that the fake kangaroo court that tried Chelsea Manning had just started and Manning was going to prison for 35 years. And someone who knew also that his predecessor, whistleblower from the NSA, a man called Thomas Drake, who had indeed gone through all the correct channels, up to and including a congressional hearing in America, had then had his house raided and been threatened with 35 years in prison. So it doesn't matter how you try and do it, how you try and follow the rules, they will still threaten you with a life in prison. And he knew all this. And he still stepped forward and did what he did. And hats off to him. I think he is the most significant whistleblower of modern history, because what he has exposed affects all of us globally, affects every citizen of the world. And without him, we would not have a chance of pushing back. So he did this. And we need to give as much support back to him, I think, as we can, and use the information that he provided to us. But of course, in Britain, it's not so easy to get that information necessarily from the mainstream media, because it was censored. It was banned under a D notice. And that's why we haven't had the coverage or the outpouring of anger here in the way that I've seen in other European countries, and particularly Germany, which is a very interesting place to live at the moment, with its collective historical memories of the Gestapo, of what it was like to live under the Stasi. And this is why it has such a strong constitution, trying to rein in the abuses of the spies. And the spies in Germany have some nasty questions to answer now. Were they colluding with the NSA with the knowledge of their political masters, and the politicians say no? Or were they acting rogue, which is what the politicians are implying, so they will be reined in? Why that cannot happen here, I do not know, apart from the strange James Bond mythology that glamorises spying in Britain. We've always been the goodies. We think we're always on the good side, the winning side of history, and our spies will protect us and not go against us. That is a load of crap. So, how should they be reined in? At the moment, the situation, the accountability situation, is appalling. It is the weakest out of any notional Western democracy. It's even worse than America. We have a situation here where MI5 is supposedly regulated by the 1989 Official Secrets Act, where MI6 and GCHQ, the listening post, the formerly secret agency, which now has been spread all over the world's media, thank you, where they were put on a legal footing in 1994 with the Intelligence Services Act, which crucially at the time also put in place in Parliament a committee called the Intelligence and Security Committee, which was supposed to have oversight responsibility of the spies. And that was a wonderful fig leaf. The politicians were really pleased with this move. They said, that's great, we know what they're doing. It turned out that in 1994, the only powers that the ISC had were to look at policy, finance and administration of the spies. They had no powers to call for witnesses. They had no powers to call for papers. They were not allowed to investigate allegations of operational wrongdoing or crime. And the spies loved it. They were cock-a-hoop when that law went through. Yes, we'd got away with it. I remember I was there. And it has been proven since that indeed they did get away with it, and they have got away with it, because time and time again, top spooks have lied to this committee, and it's now on the record. Former heads of MI5 have said, I blanched at what I didn't tell the committee. One head of MI5, Dame Eliza Manning and Buller, I say that carefully because I always get it wrong, it's bullying manner, actually lied to the committee soon after the Iraq War, basically saying that, no, of course we're not involved in torture. Her successor, Jonathan Evans, then had to admit to the committee that was not true. We had the former commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Ian Blair, lie to the committee as well, where he tried to upgrade the number of terrorist atrocities that the police and MI5 stopped in 2008. I think he doubled the number from 6 to 12 and then had to retract and say, sorry, I misled the committee. This goes on time and time and time again. Now, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, the former foreign secretary, who did not agree to the Gaddafi plot in 1996, let's give him that credit, He is now the chair of the ISC, and he's tried to beef up their powers because he's aware that civil liberties activists are concerned about this lack of oversight. So now they are allowed into the agencies to look for documents. They can call for witness statements from the spies. They can investigate operational doings. However, those powers need to be applied with a will, and that is what we are seeing as distinctly lacking. They have been exposed over the last year as the mouthpieces still of the intelligence agencies. Malcolm Rifkin, when the first disclosures came out from Edward Snowden, which specifically implicated GCHQ, said, no, no, we know exactly what they're getting up to. We know that they're obeying the law. We trust them. They're the best boys in the world. If he could not be bothered to investigate these sort of allegations of wrongdoing and immediately give them a clean bill of health, he is not holding the spies to account. And this was an operation called Tempora. I don't know how many of you remember that one. Unbelievable. This is GCHQ prostituting itself to the NSA. It sold itself to the NSA. It went to them and said, we have far less oversight than you do. We've got far more leeway under UK laws than you do under your laws. Use us to do things you're not allowed to do and give us money and we will do what you want. Now, that is prostitution by any other name. They have sold our national security down the river for money. So this Tempora program involves GCHQ mainlining all the information, all the communications carried on the transatlantic optic fibers, which is everything between America and the whole of Europe. Think about it. It's everything. And it's not just Malcolm Rifkin who said, no, 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 it's okay. We know what they're doing. They don't lie to us. And it's all legal. William Hague, the Foreign Secretary, immediately came racing out into the lists too and said, well, I'm responsible for signing any warrants of whatever GCHQ does under the Intelligence and Security Act 1994. I know that I've signed these warrants. I know that what they're doing is legal. Again, a load of crap. They do not have warrants of the breadth and depth and scale that could possibly cover the interception of a whole continent's information and communications. They could potentially get a group of telephones or a group of emails for a specific group they've made a case to investigate, but not a whole data mining trawl through an entire continent. Now, it's great that William Hague said, yes, but I've signed it off, so it's all legal under UK law. Fine. That means that, if we take him at his word, what they're doing to us in the UK is legal by the definitions of the laws that govern GCHQ. That's 60 million Europeans. What about the other 440 million who are not represented by William Hague, who have no say in this process, who are also being digitally raped? They didn't elect him. Mind you, we didn't elect him either. We just got stuck with him. So this oversight is not working. And we need serious reform, both from the media and from the political classes. We're not going to get it in this country. We are too in love with the James Bond myth. We are too in love with the idea that we're always the goodies. And so is America. You know, I still think they think they're playing cowboys and Indians half the time. We can, though, try and change things legally at a European level, because there have been moves afoot in the European Parliament. The Civil Liberties and Justice Committee, called LIBER, has been holding months-long hearings in the European Parliament, taking witness statements from technical experts, from campaigners, civil society, and many of us whistleblowers. We've all given evidence. And what I certainly recommended was an institution of the Echelon Report. How many of you remember Echelon? Many of you, I think, if you're here. This was the precursor to what's now called the Five Eyes Surveillance. This is an invidious pact between GCHQ, the NSA, and the same agencies of New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, where for decades they all shared information, they shared their product, because they could legally spy on other country citizens, but not spy on their own. So they would dip into every other country and give those countries what they wanted, and the Americans would do that to us and hand it over to GCHQ. Great. Perfect little setup. Now, this caused a scandal. Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist, wrote a report and gave evidence to the European Parliament through 1999 to 2001. And this report went into European law. It was a recommendation to wean us off this dependency, this vulnerability from the NSA. Our European Parliament recommended that we build our own technical infrastructure across Europe. We don't use the American infrastructure anymore. That we wean ourselves off the closed proprietary corporate software of the American companies as well. Things like Microsoft, Apple, and all the rest of it. This, of course, is pre-Google and Facebook, which, don't get me started on, it's even worse. This was the recommendation, and also that we use something called open source software, which is free. And when we say open source, it means that the code sourcing is open for review by anyone who understands it and wants to have a look. So it can be checked for backdoor traps. It can be checked for nasty bits of code the NSA or the GCHQ put in it. And we know it's safe. Now, if this had all been implemented in 2001, we would be looking at a very different landscape in Europe. But the report came out in July that year. And of course, the world changed 2 months later, and it was quietly forgotten. What we need is to get the European Parliament and all the European countries to reinstitute the recommendations of that report, not only to protect our privacy, but also to grow our economies and develop our knowledge bases and educate our children in safe forms of communication. Don't just go on Facebook. Don't just offer your whole life up to the NSA and GCHQ. Privacy is important. Privacy is a fundamental human right put in place in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. Along with all the other important ones, the right to life, the right not to be tortured, the right not to be extrajudicially snatched, the right to a fair trial, all those were put in place precisely because people then had very fresh and very horrific memories of what happens if all we humans do not have equal rights, which is the horrors of Nazi Germany and the Second World War. They knew how easy it was for countries, whole countries, to slide into fascism, to slide into totalitarianism. They took steps to protect their descendants from that. And we, casually, unthinkingly, bloated with ease, just give them away. On Facebook, we give all our information away. That's the spy's wet dream. In the old days, the spy spent months gathering all that sort of information on us. Now we say, here, have it. We have been very well groomed by these evil corporations. So privacy is so vital because, and this would be my final point if you'll allow me another 5 minutes, we have a situation where a lot of people will come up to me and say, I'm doing nothing wrong, I have nothing to hide. And I have three answers for that. The first is a very practical example, which was another horror disclosed by Edward Snowden. It was called a program called Optic Nerve, which remotely switches on your computer's little camera, and can watch you. And it also means that if you use Skype, or video Skype particularly, it can harvest the film that you're sending through. Now, in this world, this globalised world, many of us have loved ones abroad. We keep in contact with our families using Skype. We also, many of us, have long-distance relationships. And many of us will then keep in contact with Skype. And then, apparently, about 10% of those conversations in those long-distance relationships evolve into something that, should we say, slightly more intimate. And those images and those conversations are also being harvested by GCHQ. And the poor little staff there have had to be briefed and counselled about, you know, how they're supposed to react to this pornographic content. Poor little flowers, you know. So I'm sure in a consenting, adult, happy relationship, if you want to indulge in that, that's great, that's your choice. But you should not have to think it's being snooped on. And you're doing nothing wrong. But I'm sure you do want to keep your privacy for the purposes of those sort of communications, right? You do want to hide it. That's a practical example. The second one is the political, because living in Germany, being very aware of the history of Germany and how quickly it can be to slide into a totalitarian regime, I'm very painfully aware that the goalposts shift in the political debate. So all these new programs are hoovering up all our data and building a very, very detailed picture of all the most private aspects of our lives, including what we do in political activism, for example. And that is not just hoovered up and then discarded. It is hoovered up and stored at these super data mega farming factories in America. And it can be stored indefinitely. So at the moment, you're here, and you're demonstrating, and you're exercising your democratic right to demonstrate. But what if the laws change in the next decade? What if suddenly doing this, you are deemed to be a domestic extremist or even a terrorist? And then they can go back over 10 years' worth of data. They can say, and I saw the cameras filming us from the building behind us earlier, so-and-so is there, he's now a terrorist. And we know how they treat terrorists. And if that sounds fanciful, Occupy in London in 2011 went through precisely that, where a document was leaked from the City of London Police to all the banks in the area saying, beware of Occupy. They are domestic extremists slash terrorists in our view. They're not. They were there protesting about the 99% versus the 1%. Dangerous subversion? Extremism? Terrorism? It's crazy. So this is something to be aware of. The law won't always necessarily be the same, and the slide away from freedom can be frighteningly fast when it starts. And finally, the final point is the most esoteric I touched on before. If you do not have freedom to communicate in privacy, if you do not have the ability to talk to people, to read stuff, information, to write to people, to watch videos, to plan activism, to have a relationship online, then you begin potentially to self-censor, or you find yourself blocked from access to information that you as a concerned citizen need, and then you can't make informed choices. So privacy is the bedrock of a functioning democracy. And if we don't have privacy, we will no longer have democracy. So we need to fight for it. So just to finish, I think Edward Snowden, as I said, is the most significant whistleblower of modern history because of what he has exposed. He has given us the opportunity to realise we are on the brink. He has given us the opportunity to try and push back, both demanding legal remedy from our elected politicians, from international government, whatever. And he's also given us the chance to re-empower ourselves individually as citizens, because we don't have to expect laws and governments to protect our privacy. We can do it ourselves. We can take it upon ourselves. You can encrypt your email using something called PGP encryption. Snowden says this is still safe, pretty much. You can use anonymizing systems like Tor to view the web. You can use secure boot-ups on your computer, something like Tails. There's all sorts of things if you go and have a dig around. I'm not a techie, but I know a lot of techies, and they set up things called crypto parties where you can go along with your laptop and they will help you learn all this, and they will help you re-empower yourselves and take back your privacy. So fight for these changes, protest, demand from our political leaders political changes, but also take the responsibility back for yourselves. And just to finish, Edward Snowden is a remarkable man, and his message has been wonderfully consistent right from the start. In his very first interview, when he outed himself, he said his biggest fear was that nothing would change by his actions. His was an act of conscious civil courage, and we need to respect and honour that courage and that sacrifice, and exhibit the same conscious courage ourselves to fight back and to protect the future for our children. Thank you very much.